If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
You're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 258, entitled How to Think Faster, Make Better Decisions, and Perform Like a World-Class Fighter Pilot, I chat with Justin Hazard Lee. Justin Hazard Lee is an F-35 fighter pilot and the host of the Professionals Playbook podcast. In today's episode, Justin talks about his experiences flying all types of fighter jets, including the F-35 and other elite vehicles. Justin talks about the feeling he gets whizzing through the air, what it's comparable to, why he loves it so much, and the very real dangers of flying it. Justin also talks about the performance and the mindset needed to successfully fly such a fast and potentially deadly vehicle, and how he conditions himself before and after each flight to ensure his safety and success. If you're wondering how to think, act, and perform like a world-class fighter pilot, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. If you want to get more content, more information, and extra bonuses I don't post anywhere else, make sure you follow me on Instagram right now. It's at Justin Stenstrom. That's JustinStenstrom. I'm posting pretty much every day throughout the week, most days out of the week for sure, but almost every day. And it's all kinds of information regarding health, wealth, business, life, dating, relationships, confidence, and so much more. I'm telling you, you're going to love seeing some of the stories I post about and the feed posts I post all the time. It's pretty interesting. It's pretty fun. I'm loving Instagram right now, so make sure you follow me, Instagram.com/Justin Stenstrom, or just jump on your phone right now, pull up the Instagram app, and it's at Justin Stenstrom. Hey, just a quick reminder, just about all the links that we reference throughout the episodes can be found within the show notes. So if you're listening on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or if you're just listening directly on the website at elitemanmagazine.com, just scroll down to the bottom and you can see most of the show's links directly there. Just assume that all the links are affiliate links. Not all of them, but many of them are, but assume that they all are. And by you clicking on that link, it's just a small contribution to help continue the Elite Man podcast. I don't get a ton of money out of the affiliate links that we have on there, but I do get a small, tiny percentage of what you end up purchasing with no extra charge on your end. So just think of it as a charity gift donation to the Elite Man podcast for giving you tremendous content week in and week out. I sincerely appreciate when you purchase a book or product or service from one of these links, and so don't the authors and guests who come on the show and deliver their incredible value. So make sure you check out those show notes when you do want to make a purchase or check something out even further. It helps me out, it helps the guests out, and it helps the show out. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from Elite Man Magazine, and my guest today is Justin Hazard Lee from professionalsplaybook.com. Justin, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Hey, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Justin, you have an awesome first name, but you also have an awesome, I guess, middle name or nickname that they give you, Hazard. That's pretty badass. What is that all about?
Well, we don't really divulge where that call sign came from, but as I was telling you before, all the pilots, they don't know my first name. They call me Hazard, and every once in a while, we'll have First Name Fridays where we try to learn all the pilots' first names because, we'll go a decade knowing the same person without knowing their first name.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I didn't know about call signs, but when you mentioned it, it kind of rang a bell from the movie Top Gun. They talk about that as well, so... Basically, I mentioned a moment ago in the intro that you are a fighter pilot. How did you get into that? Were you inspired by that movie, by the way, the Top Gun movie?
Yeah, I don't think you can not be inspired by that, with at least in my generation. But I wanted to be a fighter pilot since I was 5 years old. So I think I went to an air show when I was young and I saw the Thunderbirds fly. And ever since then, I've wanted to be a fighter pilot. So I went to the Air Force Academy. It's a 4-year school. From there, I went to pilot training. And then from pilot training, got selected to fly F-16s, flew F-16s for 6 years and then transitioned over to the F-35. And now I'm stationed at Luke Air Force Base, flying the F-35, teaching the next generation of fighter pilots how to fly that aircraft.
Nice, man. And what are you up to nowadays? You have a podcast, I believe, the website as well, as I mentioned a moment ago. What are some of the things that you're teaching other people how to do?
Yeah, so I started the podcast last year. It's been about exactly 1 year since I started it, and it's been a fun journey. So it's called The Professionals Playbook. It's available anywhere you find podcasts, but I interview professionals in different fields, and we go over their successes, their failures, how they overcame those failures, what they do to perform at a high level. And I've had a chance to talk with some really amazing people, talk to Terry Virts, who is the International Space Station commander, talk to Chad Hennings, three-time Super Bowl player, talk to Thunderbird One, so the commander of the Thunderbird. So it's been a fun journey, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot to that you've learned over the years too, which is why I wanted to bring you on this show as well, to talk kind of about human performance, decision-making, the mental toughness aspect to being a fighter pilot. Are these all the things that go along with the training of being a fighter pilot and just being in the air and doing, you know, some of the crazy shit that, that we've come to know that these guys are capable of doing, and yourself included?
Well, I think at the end of the day, as fighter pilots, our job is to make good decisions. So when we go out and fly, we'll make thousands of decisions each flight. And our job is to make as many good decisions as possible and to keep them at a high level. So not all of them are going to be great. And that's where that mental toughness aspect comes into it. But we try to keep them as good as they can, because if you make one bad decision, when I was, for instance, in the F-16, we had six times the CFIT, controlled flight into terrain, that other jets had. And it was pilots misprioritizing. They were working their radar or looking in their targeting pod and ended up flying their aircraft into the ground and killing themselves. So it's really important to prioritize and make as many good decisions as you can throughout the sortie. A lot of people think that we just get handed the keys to that 35 and go fly, but we spend a lot of time preparing for that hour and 15, hour and 30 minutes that we actually do fly. The day before, we'll spend 3 hours mission planning, coming up with exactly what we want to do. The day of, we'll show up 2.5 hours prior, and we will go through all the contracts with all the people that are going to fly, exactly what we're going to do. We'll go fly, again, just for an hour, 15, hour and a half, and then we'll come back and we'll spend 2 to 6 hours debriefing every single decision that was made. And we'll spend 90% of the time on the 10% of the sortie that didn't go well. And there's more to the debrief if you want me to elaborate on that. But at the end of the day, we're trying to get pilots who make good decisions.
Yeah, just talk for a moment about that debrief, because that is pretty interesting. And you spend 90% of your time in that debrief talking about the 10% of the mistakes that you made. That's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. So we don't want to just pat ourselves on the back and talk about how well we did. It costs a lot of money to build these jets, a lot of money to fly these jets. And it would be nice if we could go out and fly every day, but we typically fly 2 to 3 times a week. And so we need to learn as much as possible from each of these flights. And there are 3 different types of errors that a pilot can make decision-wise. So they can have an error in perception. So they perceive the world in an incorrect way. And usually that comes down to missing a radio call. So there'll be a flight lead out there and he or she will miss an important radio call of where a pop-up group, an enemy aircraft is, and they'll proceed with their plan without knowing that and end up getting in a training environment shot down by that aircraft. So misperception, and that, again, comes down to prioritizing correctly. We don't want our pilots to be more than about 90% task saturated, because once you hit 100%, you're not making decisions on what you drop off. You're just dropping off things haphazardly. So at 90%, you need to start figuring out what you're going to drop, because there's always more stuff to do than you actually have the ability to do. So drop those tasks off so you don't miss those important radio calls. So that's the first one, error in perception. Next is a decision-making error. So we have a lot of plays, essentially, what we do in there. So it's like playing football, and we have all these plays. So it's really important to study all these plays so that's nearly muscle memory when we actually execute these. But if the pilot perceives the world correctly, he or she may choose the incorrect play. And so if that happens in the debrief, we'll stop it and we'll see exactly what they did wrong, what they should do in the future. And then the last mistake is an execution error. So they perceived the world correctly. They chose the right tactic or play, and then they ended up just screwing up. So to keep with the football analogy, the quarterback chose the correct receiver, just overthrew it. So that usually manifests in using the switches in your jet incorrectly. So you ended up not locking up the correct guy or something like that, or not taking a valid shot. And so we'll go through the mech of exactly how to take that shot for next time.
Nice. That's pretty interesting too. Like using the same process in real life. Have you used, or have you helped other people use this type of thing in like regular day decision making, say at the office or, you know, in different communications, different aspects of life?
I think it's very applicable. So I've had a lot of guests on the podcast, especially people that have associated with fighter pilots, for instance, flight doctors. They've told me they've incorporated a lot of these debriefing lessons into what they do in the operating room. So analyzing what you're doing, I think it's easy to get caught up in the weeds and try to accomplish as many tasks as possible. But at some point throughout your day, you need to take a 30,000 foot view of what exactly is going on, what I'm trying to do, and how I can do that better.
Is there a certain amount of time or say number of times that you go through training before you become a certain level of proficient in this thing? Because if you're doing all this debriefing and looking back and then deciding, you know, you're spending 90% of that debrief going back and figuring out the mistakes that you made so you don't do them again next time. Is there a certain amount of times that you've noticed over the years or that they tell you, you know, your trainers that it takes before you hit a certain level of proficiency in this regard?
I think you never feel like you're completely proficient. You're always working to get a little bit better. For me, transitioning from the F-16 to the F-35, it took me about a year to start to feel comfortable with the jet. When I first started flying it, I knew what I wanted to do because I had that experience in the F-16, but it took my hands about 5 seconds to actually do what I wanted it to do. And we'll fly with closure rates as fast as a mile every 3 seconds. So it's really important to get that muscle memory down so you can spend more time thinking about exactly how to do your tactics and making sure you're executing correctly. So I've been flying since 2010. So coming up, yeah, I guess 10 years I've been flying, and there's still plenty for me to learn. So it's one of those jobs where you're always trying to iterate, always trying to get a little bit better. For pilot training, it takes about a year. You start off in a T6, which is a high performance prop plane. It's almost like a P-51 Mustang performance wise, maybe a little bit less. You spend 6 months there learning how to fly. Then you go and take those skills to the T-38. So the T-38 supersonic jet trainer, you fly, do everything you did in the T6 and the T-38. And then at the end of that, a few people will be selected to go and fly fighters. And so I was selected to fly the F-16. You spend about 9 months to a year learning how to fly the F-16. And that's what I'm doing here. I'm training those new pilots coming in right out of pilot training. And then they'll go out to the combat Air Force, so where they'll actually be deployed and go to combat. And from there, they'll just be wingmen. So they cannot lead anybody around. All their job is to do is to listen to their flight lead who's leading them around. And they'll fly in two or four ships. And then after about 2 years of that, they will transition to become a flight lead where they're in charge of four people when they go out and fly. And then about a year or two later, they'll become an instructor pilot where they can teach those young new pilots how to fly the F-16 or the F-35.
How fast did you say that the F-16, you said a mile per 3 seconds? Is that like 1,700 miles an hour or something like that?
Yeah, with closure rates. So we're going to be flying about Mach 1 and then enemy fighters flying about Mach 1.9 Mach towards you. So that translates to a mile every 3 seconds.
Wow. What are some of the other ones that you mentioned, like the training ones? Are they a lot slower?
Yeah, the T6, it's been a long time since I've flown that, but I think maybe about 300 knots for the T6. So it's a prop plane, so it'll fly maybe 0.5 Mach, so half the speed of sound, or about half as fast as you're flying in an airliner. The T-38, that plane was designed in the 50s, and so it has really small engines. But in order for the engineers to make that thing go supersonic, they had to make it almost like a lawn dart. So very, very aerodynamic, which means when you're actually trying to land it, you're trying to land slowly, and it lands very, very quickly. And they've had a lot of fatalities over the years with student pilots learning how to land the T-38 because it doesn't have the power to be able to pull up out of a stall when you're landing.
Oh, wow. So there's less room for mistake on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the top speed on that?
I can't remember the top speed on that. Again, it's been probably about 9 years since I've flown that aircraft.
Half a Mach? What is a Mach speed? What's that?
So Mach is the speed of sound. So if you ever see a lightning flash and then the sound a little bit after it, that sound is traveling at the speed of sound. So it depends on temperature, but call it about 600 miles an hour is what Mach is. And that's what we use to talk about how fast aircraft go.
Okay, cool. I mean, these are all impressive speeds, and it sounds, I'm like just trying to picture, like, what is that feeling like when you're inside of the fighter jet? Is it comparable to anything else, like a super fast roller coaster, or say like flying down a mountain if you're snowboarding or riding a motorcycle? Is there anything that's even comparable to it?
It's a little bit like a roller coaster. So one of the biggest things we have to deal with are G forces. So right now we're at 1G, so I weigh 200 pounds at 1G. And if you've ever been on a roller coaster where it does a loop and kind of pushes your head down a little bit, that's about 2.5, maybe 3 Gs. We'll pull up to 9 Gs in these jets, which is right on the limit of the human body. And a lot of us, so that'll be at 9 Gs, I weigh with my gear on over 2,000 pounds, over a ton. Just on my neck alone, it's 135 pounds. So think of barbell and 2 45-pound plates just on your neck when you're flying. So we have a lot of pilots long-term that have back and neck issues, and so we'll have physical therapists that work with us and try to keep our careers going for a little bit longer. But in the short term, the biggest issue is blacking out. So in the F-16, we lost about one pilot a year, every year for the last 30 years, to a G-induced loss of consciousness. So you're flying, and that blood is being pulled into your arms and legs. And if enough blood is pulled, then you'll pass out. And typically, you'll be incapacitated for about 30 seconds. And at the speeds we fly, we'll most likely impact the ground in about 15 or 20 seconds. So we've had a lot of pilots end up dying from that. And so we wear G suits, and that helps to squeeze the blood back into our brain. We also do a lot with human performance. So if you're just 2% dehydrated, your G tolerance decreases by 20%. So it's important to stay hydrated. It's important to sleep well. It's important to eat well. It's important to work out your legs. It's important to have cardio so you can push all that blood back up. And it's it just takes one time to go less than 9 Gs and to pull more for you to pass out and potentially kill yourself. So all those things add up. So you might not have slept well the night before. You might not have eaten well. You might be sore from a workout. Right now, I could probably pull, I would guess, maybe 11 or 12 Gs, but each one of those will bring you down, and it just takes one time to end up killing you. So it's important to be able to do a good G strain to handle the Gs. And after I fly, if I look at my arms, I'll have, it looks like chicken pox, and that's blood pooling in my arms and actually bursting the blood vessels.
Wow.
So Gs are something that doesn't translate really well. You won't see that in Top Gun, at least the first one.
Yeah. How often can you go out on these flights? So I got two questions. How often can you go out on a flight like this? Because it sounds like it takes a toll on you. And then how often are you able to stay in a high G range for, like, say, the 9 and up range? Is it just a couple of minutes, or can you do that for an extended period?
Yeah, so we actually will sometimes double turn. So we'll do 2 flights in one day. Typically, that's rare. We'll get about 2 to 3 flights a week, but we can push it up to do 2 flights in a day. So that's the answer to your first question. For the second one, it just depends on the speed you enter the turn. So if you enter the turn going Mach 1, you can maintain that 9 Gs for a couple minutes. But typically your turn radius will increase quite a bit, and we're trying to keep our turn radius short so we can point our jet at the enemy fighter and engage them with a missile. So we'll be flying just under the speed of sound, and with F-16, you could sustain that for about a minute or two, the jet could, and then in the F-35, it's a little bit less, but it really depends on the circumstances. If you really wanted to, you could get the jet to sustain that for a long time.
So you're doing two flights a day on average when you're active and out there, and how long are the flights in totality each?
Well, we'll do 2 to 3 flights a week. So it just depends on the schedule. It changes quite a bit, and also changes a lot if you're in combat. But for a typical bases training schedule, you'll fly 2 to 3 times, maybe 4 times a week, and the flights will be about an hour and a half. So we burn a lot of gas. Typically, we're limited by the amount of gas that we have. In the F-16, we only carried internally about 7,000 pounds of gas, and in max afterburner, I could burn 50,000 pounds of gas an hour. So you can burn through all your gas very quickly, which is why we try to emphasize fuel management to the young pilots. So about an hour and a half, gas limited. In the F-35, we carry a little bit more, and sometimes it becomes airspace limited because we have so many jets trying to use the same airspace.
Yeah, is the gas burning up faster in a fighter jet than, say, a commercial airplane?
Much, much faster.
Is it just because there's so much more performance to it?
Yeah, it's all about performance. And then we have an afterburner. So an afterburner, we have basically a regular jet engine on our jet. And then we also have an afterburner, which is basically a flamethrower. So it injects that gas extremely quick. So 50,000 pounds of fuel an hour can be injected into the F-16 engine and lit on fire. So it's not efficient, but it'll get you that extra boost of thrust for a little bit.
Yeah, and going back to something you mentioned a moment ago, which was like you're constantly working out, you're taking care of your body, you're getting your optimal sleep, diet, nutrition, hydration, all that stuff. When you're up in the air going through the movements and doing some of these crazy things that you do, is it a conscious decision to move the blood flow to different parts of your body or to like fight off the effects of potentially passing out? And are you like aware of all this, or is it just like all that stuff is done beforehand so your like unconscious mind can take control of it and be at its best while you're doing it? Does that make sense?
Yeah, we're doing a G strain during high G maneuvers, and that's where you squeeze your calves, thighs, butt, abs. You keep your upper body relaxed, 2/3 of a breath, and you're squeezing that blood back in your head. So,
okay.
So we'll do that while we're flying. But in order to be able to sustain that over a long period of time, that's when you have to work out and make sure you're hydrated. And out here in Phoenix, the temperature can sometimes be 110, 120 degrees out. So you're already starting to get a little bit dehydrated once you get out to the jet.
Do you have any food or liquid to drink and stay hydrated during the flights, or is it just like a tight space and there's nothing else you can really have in there?
So the F-16, it was basically a stripped down hot rod. There is no extra fat in the F-16. And so there's still enough for like a water bottle. And when I was in Afghanistan, we were doing four to occasionally 8 hour flights in Afghanistan. And so you need to eat, you need to stay hydrated. I would end up bringing some peanut butter and a protein shake, and I would kind of sip on that throughout the flight, and then I'd have a water bottle that I would drink throughout the flight. So the F-16, very little space, and F-35 has a little bit more space, but it's still not very much. With both jets, there'd be an instrument console right between my legs, so you really can't move around very much. And in fact, especially in the F-16, I would feel a little bit claustrophobic on the ground. But once you got into the air, that's the jet's natural element. And we call it strapping the jet on our back. So you almost become one with the jet. And so I can remember times when I wanted to look to the right, and instead of actually turning, I would just turn the jet to look. So once you're in there, it doesn't feel too bad.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. It's kind of reminds me of the motorcycle too. You're like one with the motorcycle when you're riding. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you want to make a turn, you just kind of like lean one way or another. There's so much more performance in obviously a fighter jet, but it's kind of a I can kind of sense what you're talking about. So it's pretty cool, man. And what's the most exciting or best part of actually being in that and being able to fly it? Is there anything that really sticks out?
I would say for me, it's going out and successfully completing a mission. So we've mostly talked about just what's happening in my cockpit, but when we go out, we'll be in charge of 4 aircraft. Usually we go to a red flag, which is a big exercise. I've been in charge of 75 aircraft flying, and I really enjoy the mission planning aspect. So you have objectives that you need to accomplish. You need to bring the team together, and it's a lot of project management stuff, trying to figure out a good plan, going and executing that plan. And then the F-35, our strength is our situational awareness. So going from the F-16, which was a fourth generation fighter, it was designed in the 70s, to the F-35, it's like going from a 1960s Corvette to a new Tesla. So a lot more capabilities, a lot more things that you can do. And so we'll be the mission commanders typically out there, and you're making smart audibles trying to figure out what's going on, because each mission isn't going to go exactly according to plan. So you need a mission commander to be able to make real-time decisions and smart audibles throughout the mission to achieve success. So to me, it's making those strategic decisions while flying. That's what I get the most enjoyment out of.
So what are some of those missions? Like you mentioned before, you were in combat. What were some of the things that you had to do in combat and experienced?
Yeah, so we were deployed to Bagram Air Base, Afghanistan. We were the only fighter squadron in the country, which means we were in charge of the entire battlefield in terms of fast CAS. And we were doing 24-hour ops. So there's only a 2-ship of F-16s airborne at any given time. So if you were that flight lead, you were in charge of 100% of the fast CAS out there. And then Secretary of Defense James Mattis had taken over, and he said he wanted all ISIS annihilated. So the pace of operation jumped through the roof once that happened, and we were pretty much cleaning the rails, which means we were dropping all our bombs every sortie. So typically we were supporting the troops on the ground. So there'd be a special operations force that was doing a clearing operation. They might be ambushed, and we would have to show up and determine where they were, where the bad guys were, and end up dropping bombs on the bad guys.
So when you're up in the sky, are you communicating directly with the people on the ground? Like, how does that work, and how do you know when and where to drop the bombs? I'm guessing there's like a radar thing, but how does that actually look?
Yeah, so close air support, it's very difficult to do. Even today with all our technology, it's very tough to figure out where the good guys are, where the bad guys are, where the civilians are, and make sure you're taking out the bad guys without harming the other two. So the primary method still is using the radio. So we'll have radios, and we'll show up typically in a close air support wheel about 15,000 feet. We'll be flying a wheel around the target or even the friendlies, depending on where they want us. And we'll be looking through our targeting pod to try and find what's going on. They'll usually give us a grid, which is a stake in the ground of where they want us to look via coordinates. And then from there, they'll talk us on to where the enemy fire is coming from. And this is coming from a JTAC who's very experienced, has done a lot of training, because things look completely differently to the air as they do to the ground. So these guys are top-notch. They're out there in the mud. And, for instance, we don't have color in our targeting pod, so it would be real easy for them to say, hey, bomb this blue roof building, but we can't see that it's a blue roof. And it looks a lot different from the vantage point. So they'll talk us through where the enemy is. If it's real close to the friendlies, it's called danger close. So in Afghanistan, I dropped probably about a dozen danger close weapons, and that's where the friendlies on the ground determine that the concentration and accuracy of the enemy fire is worth dropping a bomb that may injure themselves. And so the ground commander will sign off on that, and then we will roll in and we'll drop our bombs. In Afghanistan, that was a mix of GBU-54s, which are combined GPS laser bombs, 500 pounds, so about 2 or 3 times what a person weighs. And then GBU-38s, which are also 500 pounds. They're GPS guided. And then we were also dropping GB31s, which are 2,000 pound bombs, about the weight of a car. So we're dropping, that was pretty much where we were dropping out in Afghanistan. So we'll drop that, and then we'll get, see what the effects happen on the ground. And then if there's still enemy fire, we'll go in for a reattack.
Nice. So do you guys, do any of the fighter jets still have ammo that they shoot out? Like, you know, in some of the movies you see just like shooting each other and flying around, and it's kind of like a gun on a plane. It's just shooting off of the jet itself. Do any of them still have that, or is it just all primarily bombs?
Yeah, just about all of them still have the gun. So back in Vietnam, they got rid of the gun with the F-4, and that proved to be a mistake. So almost all fighters have some sort of gun. In the F-16, we had a six-barrel Gatling gun, and it could shoot. It's been a couple of years, but I think 6,000 rounds a minute. And in Afghanistan, I strafed three times with the gun. So it's a 20-millimeter shell with a high explosive incendiary in it. So it doesn't have to hit the person to actually do damage. It just has, it's like a little mini grenade. So that's what we had in the F-16. And we carried 510 rounds in the F-16. And at the speeds that the gun fired, you could use up all your ammo in 5 seconds. So it was a pretty formidable weapon that we still ended up using. And in the F-35, we have a 25-millimeter gun. It shoots a little bit less quickly, but we don't carry as many rounds.
So you could shoot off all your rounds in 5 seconds. You said 6,000 shots per minute too, but why would you want to use up all the rounds in 5 seconds? Wouldn't that harm you if you needed it again in, say, like a minute later?
It could, but based on you want concentration of firepower. So you don't get a whole lot of passes, especially with the F-16, not a lot of gas. So when you do get a good shot, you want to use pretty much as much of your ammo as possible. And we would typically train for 3 separate trigger squeezes. So you would be in a wheel, and you would roll in, you would squeeze off about a third of your ammo. You'd do a safe escape, you'd roll around and do that 3 times total and burn up all of your ammo.
Wow. That is insane how many rounds are fired off in that short of time. Mm. How accurate, too, are these bombs when you say you drop them? Are they like, I don't know if this is true, it might have just been a total made-up story, but someone once told me that they have the capability now, this was like maybe a decade ago, so I'm guessing it would still apply now, obviously, but I don't even know if it was ever true, but you could drop a bomb through like a chimney in somebody's house. Like, that's how accurate the technology has gotten. Is that anywhere near remotely true?
It depends on a lot of factors, but it's very accurate. I can't talk about the specifics, but just imagine strapping your phone. So if you open up your Apple Maps, you can see where you are pretty precisely. So we have GPS bombs that do that, and we have combined laser bombs. So it'll go after your laser spot if you want to move from where the GPS coordinates were midair to where your laser spot is right now.
It just seems like, that is insane, but it just seems like with the speed that you're at, and you know, the winds and just the other natural factors of the bomb coming to the ground, that it would be impossible to do something like that. How does that actually work to identify the exact location? Is it pulling something from the ground up? And I don't know, just trying to like see that in my mind's eye, and I just can't picture it.
Yeah, so we have a GPS and INS as well in the jet, and so we know the exact coordinates of where we are. We fly with a targeting pod, and it has a laser rangefinder. So if we know exactly where we are, now the targeting pod can figure out exactly where we're looking at. And so we can generate coordinates from that and give it to the bomb. Or if it's a high-value target, maybe the intelligence community is following somebody, and they can generate coordinates via drones or other things out there and give it to us, and then we can drop on those exact coordinates. So there's a whole bunch of different ways to drop our weapons, which is why it takes a lot of studying every day. It's to go back to the sports analogy, every day you're practicing to get a little bit better and to have more of these tools in your toolkit to be able to execute it, because there are a lot of different ways to drop a lot of these different weapons. And it's so much more lethal to be able to have accurate weapons. Back in World War II, they would need to drop thousands of bombs because they were unguided, dumb bombs. They didn't have good target sites. So you need a whole fleet of B-17s just to take out one factory. In Vietnam, they shortened it because they had now better sights. And then in the first Gulf War, that's when the first smart bombs came about. And then you saw the F-117s, those stealth fighters going in the early 90s, taking out weapons. And it just progressed. So now just a two-ship of F-16s can be extremely lethal.
Yeah, that is awesome. It's crazy how far we've come with technology, but it's so cool like where we're at with it. Mm-hmm. How many other fighter pilots out there are there like you who do this kind of work? I'm sure that, like you said, we don't need like so many of them anymore like we used to in the past. How many are still around and active?
So in the U.S., I would say maybe about 1,500. Don't quote me on that number. I don't know the exact amount because fighter pilots typically can do other jobs as well. So they may later in their career be pulled to a job at the Pentagon, or they may be going to some sort of leadership school. So it's a little bit nebulous. A couple of years ago, we were having pilots pulled to be ALOs on the ground, so air liaison officers. So they were a little bit like those JTACs on the ground calling in airstrikes, but they would kind of talk to the guys on the ground and tell them, this is what we do in the air. This is our tactics. This is how you can best utilize us. So just because you are a fighter pilot in the career field doesn't mean you're actually flying a fighter jet. So I feel very fortunate to have been in a frontline fighter my entire career. I spent, the first bit in the F-16, and now I'm in the F-35. I'd say maybe 1,500 would be a rough estimate.
Just kind of going back to what you talked about, human performance and decision-making, what are some of the skills that you've learned and now apply in your day-to-day life when you're not, active and actually flying some of these planes and you're just kind of walking around on the street? What are some of the skills that you now possess from all that training that you use in just, say, regular life?
Well, I think going the opposite direction, one thing that really helped me out flying was meditating. So I started meditating full-time pretty much back in when I was deployed to Afghanistan. The days were pretty stressful. I started meditating 10 minutes every morning, and that was in 2016. And I've only missed one day since then. So every morning I start the day with 10 minutes of meditation, and that helps out quite a bit in staying in the present moment. And that kind of goes back to when I was at the Air Force Academy. I was a boxer, and the Air Force Academy is located in Colorado Springs, which is right near the Olympic Training Center. And so they would have sports psychologists every once in a while come over and work with us on visualization, self-talk, and staying in the present moment. So meditation is one of those things that you have to do it consistently. You have to do it at least, I think, 5 minutes a day, but you see benefits throughout your entire breadth of what you do. So that's helped out quite a bit for me. And then I guess to answer your question a little bit more specifically, prioritization. So having been flying for about a decade in the Air Force, it's helped me to prioritize tasks very quickly and in the correct order. So I would say that those are the two takeaways.
Yeah, it seems like the meditation is huge. I've talked about that many times on the show as well. And I meditated for like 4 months straight for a half an hour every day, like towards the evening, like towards the end of the night. And I've only missed in like the last 6 months, I've missed like 2 days. So I'm a huge meditator myself. And I only picked that up the last year or so. Like I was kind of playing around with it at first and I got really into it just because there are so many benefits across the board. But the prioritization thing is really important as well. I think especially with like entrepreneurs and people, a lot of our listeners are entrepreneurs or people that are trying to, start their own business and kind of do their own thing. The prioritization thing is something I think a lot of people are missing these days, and it's easy to get distracted. It's more easy to get distracted these days than it was 5, 10, 20 years ago with, all the social media, the technology, the smartphones. The prioritization thing just kind of, I think it puts the biggest focus on front and center for you to do, and then you can get down the little things. Like every single day I create a list of what I want to do, and there's a couple things at the very top of the list that I absolutely have to get done, and then all the other things are stuff that I hope to get done or that if I have enough time I'll get done. But I think a lot of people lose focus, and it's easy to get distracted and just kind of focus on some of those outside things that aren't really that important, and then the next thing you know your day's gone and you're wishing the next day to do it, and then you kind of keep putting it off.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, especially when you're dealing with some sort of open-ended job. For instance, podcasting. I'm sure you've had this experience too. There's an unlimited amount of things you could do. You could do this 24/7 for years and not accomplish everything that you want to do. So it's a lot tougher when you're an entrepreneur or working on some sort of project like that. And one of the things that's helped me is I have a three task rule. So in the morning when I wake up, when the day is calm before I get pulled into the various fires, I will come up with three things that I need to do for that day that will make me satisfied. And if I do those three things, then I can be happy with what I've done and I can spend time working out. I can spend time with family more. I can spend time relaxing without feeling guilty. So the three tasks rule has helped me out quite a bit in terms of being able to slow down a little bit. I'm probably like a lot of people. I can be a workaholic, and that's not a good thing, because as I go throughout the day, my decision making insidiously becomes less and less good. So it's not good to just, in my opinion, to just work the whole day straight. So coming up with those three tasks, it really prioritizes what you have to do. And if you do three things a day for 365 days, you can get quite a bit done.
Yeah, it's very true. I'm the same way, workaholic. Sometimes I'll just get caught up in doing something and it's like, I want to get this done. And I'm looking up at the time and it's just like, oh my God, time has flown by. And it's like, I'm starting to lose sleep. It's starting to cut into my sleep now. Now I got to like just tell myself to stop doing it, because if I don't, I'm probably going to get just a couple hours of sleep. And, you know, it's tough to do that for me too. Like I want to get things done. I want to engage. I want to finish it as fast as possible. And I know it's something that I want to get done, but it's a balance of finding, like you said, that kind of, you know, when to turn things off and when to turn it on. And it's not good to just constantly work through the day. As you know, like you mentioned before, I think having a 2% decrease in your performance can be, or what was it?
Yeah. 2% dehydrated can lower your G tolerance by 20%.
Yeah. By 20%. I mean, that just goes to show you, like, there's just micro effects that if you delay them or put them off can have a huge impact in like your overall performance, the macro performance of what you're trying to get done. So at the end of the day, you got to kind of be conscious of how things are going and how your body's actually performing. Do you find it difficult, Justin, to turn it off, say from, you know, flying around the air, going at these crazy speeds and just having like this very thrilling, exciting life to then coming back to civilian life and just kind of being a normal guy? Like, is it tough for you not to speed down the highway going, you know, buck 20 and in and out of traffic, cutting people out? Like, how do you factor that? How do you get that balance in your day-to-day life when you're just being a regular civilian as opposed to, you know, flying in the air?
I kind of think of it, at least for me, it's the opposite. I kind of get that all out there and then I can just relax and do something else throughout the rest of the day. So I'm not really a speed junkie. I get that out at work and then I can come home and I can spend time with my family. I have my first kid on the way this March. So really excited to start being a dad. So for me, it's not too tough to be able to, I guess, sync those things up.
Yeah, I guess you're right. It is like, you know, you have your balance as it is and you're getting your thrills out when you're up in the sky. You don't need any more of them down here. But, Justin, it's been an awesome interview, man. I really do appreciate it. What is the last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave the Elite Man audience and then a place our listeners can check out your work?
Oh, that's a tough one. I would say that if you have a goal, design a plan around that. Based on my own experience and some of the guests that have been successful that have come on my podcast, they kind of balance the dichotomy between having a vision, having a goal that's way off in the distance, being able to see what direction they have to march, and then shutting that out, looking down at their feet, and it's left foot, right foot, and they're just doing that each day and moving towards that goal, because it's easy to get intimidated by how far away that goal is. So balancing the dichotomy of building a plan around where you need to go and then staying in the day-to-day and executing that plan. So that would be probably the biggest takeaway message that I would say. And then yeah, you can find my podcast. It's called The Professionals Playbook. And then I also do a lot on Instagram and LinkedIn at Justin Fighter Pilot.
Awesome. Justin, thanks again for coming on, man. Really appreciate it. And I know our guys are going to love this one. So take care. I'll talk to you soon.
Appreciate it, Justin. Thank you for having me on.
Here's the truth. There are currently 450 million people globally who at any given minute harbor mental illness. Of these 450 million sufferers, 800,000 each year can no longer endure their mental affliction any further and end up taking their own lives. It's a sad but harsh reality of the world we live in. Far too many people are living unhappy lives and far too many people are dying because of it. This epidemic has to stop. But thus far, the studies only indicate that it's getting worse. We all know someone who has committed suicide, and for some of us, we may even know several individuals who have. It's a true tragedy in every sense of the word when we get that call, read that text, or see that social media post and wonder, what if, to ourselves. Suicide is the epitome of wasted talent and the quintessence of heartache. It has to stop. And it will. Elite Mind gives readers the precise tools to defeat their mental woes. Whether their fight is suicide or whether it's depression or whether it's the anxiety that's overthrown their day-to-day psyche, Elite Mind gives step-by-step strategies for mental mastery. For those needing eternal reprieve from their mental anguish, this book is a godsend. But Elite Mind's effect doesn't stop there. For as many millions of people as there are dealing with clinical mental illness, there are many millions more just floating by in life. The countless millions, perhaps even billions, who drift through life bored, lethargic, and unhappy, it's almost as if they have no pulse, but in fact they do. They want to change and they want to have a life they actually enjoy. They're simply unaware of how to snap out of their self-imposed spell. Perhaps this sounds like you. If so, Elite Mind is the antidote you need. Through its compendium of action-packed strategies for success, distinctly exhilarating first-person narratives, and uproariously funny accounts of exemplary tales of mischief and adventure, Elite Mind will keep you on the edge of your seat while imparting the wisdom you need for change. Elite Mind not only shows you how to get back in the game, but how to thrive when you do. It guides you into unleashing your inner confidence, finding your true purpose, and cultivating happiness in life that you've only experienced in your wildest dreams. Elite Mind is the perfect blend of narrative allure and practical how-to. It takes the ordinarily mundane topic of mental health and entertains and excites you while simultaneously informing you and giving you a real-world account of how to win the battle with your mind and create the life you've always wanted. If you want to end your anxiety or depression, get this book. If you want to unleash your inner confidence, get this book. If you want to arm yourself with the tools needed to live an extraordinary life full of happiness and success, get this book. Stop wasting your time and life and order this book today. Pre-order right now. If you do like the Kindle copy, get it right now at elitemanmagazine.com/elitemind or mark your calendars for January 28th, 2020, just a couple of short months away when you can actually get your hands on the paperback copy or listen to the audiobook. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I'd like you to do, and that's this. Subscribe to our podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast episodes and all of our world-class advice absolutely free. Subscribe now if you haven't already and become an Elite Man today. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an amazing review. We really do appreciate it.